Twentyman Jones said, I am afraid Mr. Moses will head the list of those we will be laying off at the end of the month. He is a dangerous man. We will simply have to get shot of him. They are getting rid of him simply because the two of us are friends. Shasta saw through it. It's because of me. He was swamped with a sense of guilt, and guilt was followed almost immediately by anger. Quick words leapt to his tongue. He wanted to cry, it's not fair. But before he spoke, he looked at Twentyman Jones and knew intuitively that any defence he attempted of Moses would only seal the boss boy's fate. He shrugged. You know what is best, sir, he agreed, and he saw the slight relaxation in the set of the old man's shoulders. Mater, he thought. I will talk to Mater. And then, with intense frustration, if only I could do it myself. If only I could say what must be done. And then it dawned upon him that this was what his mother had meant when she spoke of power. The ability to change and direct the orders of existence that surrounded him. Power, he whispered to himself. One day I will have power. Enormous power. The work in the mill house was more exacting and interesting. The friable weathered ore was loaded into the bins and then fed through the hoppers onto the rollers, which crushed it to the correct consistency for the washing gear. The machinery was massive and powerful, the din almost deafening as the ore tumbled out of the hoppers into the feed chute and was sucked into the spinning steel rollers with a continuous roar. 150 tons an hour. It went in one end as chalky lumps, the size of ripe watermelons, and poured out the far end as gravel and dust. Annalise's brother, Stoffel, who had on Shasta's last visit to the Harney adjusted the timing on his old Ford, and who was also the skilled mimic of bird calls, was now an apprentice in the mill house. He was delegated to show Shasta around, and he undertook the assignment with gusto and relish. You have to be goddamn careful with the mucking settings on the rollers, or you crush the bloody diamonds to powder. Stoffel emphasized his newly acquired manliness and authority with oaths and obscenity. Come on, Shasta, I'll show you the grease points. All points have to be grease-gunned at the beginning of every shift. He crawled under the bank of thundering rollers, shouting into Shasta's ear to make himself heard. Last month, one of the other apprentices got his mucking arm in the bearing. It pulled it off like a chicken's wing, man. You should have seen the blood. Ghoulishly, he pointed out the dried stains on the concrete floor and galvanized walls. Man, I tell you, he squirted blood like a garden hose. Stoffel climbed the steel catwalk like a monkey, and they looked down on the roller mill tables. One of the Ovambo Kaffirs fell off here, right smack into the ore bin. There wasn't even a scrap of bone bigger than your finger left of him when he came out the other end of the rollers. Yeah, man, it's a bloody dangerous job, he told Shasta proudly. You've got to keep on your mucking toes all the time. When the mine hooter blew the lunch hour, he led Shasta around to the shady side of the mill house, and they perched comfortably on the ventilator housing. Under the sanction of the workplace, they could associate quite openly, and Shasta felt grown up and important in his blue workman's overalls as he opened the lunchbox that the chef at the bungalow had sent down for him. Chicken and tongue sandwiches and jam roly-poly, he checked the contents. Do you want some, Stoffel? No, man. Here comes my sister with my lunch. And Shasta lost all interest in his own lunchbox. Annalisa was pedalling down the avenue on a black-framed Rudge, with the nest of canteens dangling from the handlebars. It was the first time that he had seen her since the meeting at the pump house, though he had looked for her each day since then. She had tucked her skirts into her bloomers to keep them clear of the chain. She stood up on the pedals and her legs pumped rhythmically as she came through the gates of the mill house, and the wind flattened the thin stuff of her dress against the front of her body. Her breasts were disproportionately large for her slim brown limbs. Shasta watched her with total fascination. She became aware of him, sitting beside her brother, and her entire bearing changed. She dropped back onto the saddle and squared her shoulders, lifting one hand from the handlebars to try and smooth the wind-blown tangle of her hair. She braked the Rudge, stepped down off the pedals and propped the machine against the bottom of the ventilator housing. "What's for lunch, Lisa?" Stoffel Boother demanded. "Sausage and mass," she handed the canteens up to him. "Same as always." The sleeves of her dress were cut back, and when she lifted her arms, Shasta saw the bush of coarse blonde hair in her armpits, tangled and wet with perspiration. And he crossed his legs quickly. "Sis, man!" Stoffel registered his disgust. "It's always sausage and mash." "Next time I'll ask Ma to cook fillet steak and mushrooms," she said, and she lowered her arms. And Shasta realized he was staring but could not stop himself. She pulled the opening at the neck of her blouse closed, and he saw the faint flush under the suntan skin at her throat, but she had not yet looked directly at him. "Thanks for nothing." Stoffel dismissed her, but she lingered. "You can have some of mine," Shasta offered. "I'll swap you," Stoffel offered generously, and Shasta glanced into the canteen and saw the lumpy potato mash swimming in thin, greasy gravy. "I'm not hungry," Shasta said, and he looked at the girl for the first time. "Would you like a sandwich, Annalisa?" She smoothed the skirt over her hips and looked directly at him at last. Her eyes slanted like a wild cat's, and she grinned slyly. "When I want something from you, Shasta Courtney, I will whistle for it. Like this." She pouted her lips into a rosy cupid's bow and whistled like a snake charmer, at the same time slowly raising her forefinger in an unmistakably obscene gesture. Stoffel let out a delighted guffaw and punched Shasta's arm. "Man, she's got the hots for you!" While Shasta blushed scarlet and sat speechless with shock, Annalisa turned away deliberately and picked up the bicycle. She went out through the gates, standing on the pedals and swinging the Rudge from side to side under her, so that her tight round buttocks oscillated with each stroke. That evening, as he turned Prester John onto the pipe track, Shasta's pulse started to gallop with anticipation. And as he approached the pump house, he slowed the pony to a walk, afraid of disappointment, reluctant to turn the corner of the building. Yet he was still not prepared for the shock when he saw her. She was draped languidly against one of the stanchions of the pipeline, and Shasta was speechless as she came slowly upright and sauntered to the head of his pony without looking up at the rider. She held the cheek strap of his halter and crooned to the pony, "What a pretty boy." The pony blew through his nostrils and shifted his weight. "What a lovely soft nose." She stroked his muzzle with a lingering touch. "Would you like a little kiss, then, my pretty boy?" She pursed her lips, pink and soft and moist, and glanced up at Shasta before she leaned forward and deliberately kissed the pony's muzzle, slipping her arms around his neck. She held the kiss for long seconds and then laid her cheek against the pony's cheek. Beginning to sway, humming softly in her throat and rocking her hips gently, she at last looked up at Shasta with those sly, slanting eyes. He was struggling to find something to say, confused by the rush of his emotions, and she moved slowly to the pony's shoulder and stroked his flank. so strong. Her hand brushed Shasta's thigh lightly, almost unintentionally, and then came back more deliberately, and she was no longer looking at his face. He could not cover himself, could not hide his violent reaction to her touch, and suddenly she let out a shocking screech of laughter and stood back with both hands on her hips. "Are you going to camp out, Shasta Courtney?" she demanded, and he was puzzled and embarrassed. He shook his head dumbly. "Then what are you putting up a tent for?" she hooted, gazing shamelessly at the front of his breeches, and he doubled up awkwardly in the saddle. With a disconcerting change of mood, she seemed to take pity on him, and she went back to the pony's head and led him along the track, giving Shasta a chance to recover his composure. "What did my brother tell you about me?" she asked without looking round. "Nothing," he assured her. "Don't believe what he says." She was unconvinced. "He always tries to make out bad things about me. Did he tell you about Forey, the driver?" Everybody at the mine knew how Gerhard Forey's wife had caught the two of them in the cab of his truck after the Christmas party. Forey's wife was older than Anneliese's mother, but she had blackened both the girl's eyes and torn her only good dress to tatters. "He didn't tell me anything," Shasta reiterated stoutly, and then with interest, "what happened?" "Nothing," she said quickly. "It was all lies." And then with another change of direction, "would you like me to show you something?" "Yes, please," Shasta answered with alacrity. He had an inkling of what it might be. "Give me an arm." She came to his stirrup and he leaned down and they hooked elbows. He swung her up, and she was light and strong. She sat behind him astride the pony's rump and slid both arms around Shasta's waist. "Take the path to the left," she directed him, and they rode in silence for 10 minutes. "How old are you?" she asked at last. "Almost 15. He stretched the truth a little, and she said, "I'll be 16 in 2 months." If there had been any doubts as to who was in charge, this declaration effectively settled it. Shasta deferred to her, and she felt it in his carriage. She pressed her breasts to his back as though to emphasize her control, and they were big and rubbery hard, and burned him through his thin cotton shirt. "Where are we going?" he asked after another long silence. They had bypassed the bungalow. "Hush up! I'll show you when we get there." The track had narrowed and become rougher. Shasta doubted anybody had passed this way in months, other than the small wild beasts that still lived this close to the mine. Finally, it petered out altogether against the base of the cliff, and Anneliese slid down from the pony's back. "Leave your horse here." He tethered the pony and looked around him with interest. He had never been so far along the base of the cliffs. They must be 3 miles from the bungalow, at least. Below them, the scree slope plunged downwards at a steep angle, and the ground was riven with gorges and ravines, all of them choked with rank, thorny undergrowth. "Come on," Anneliese ordered. "We haven't got much time. It will be dark soon." She ducked under a branch and started down the slope. "Hey!" Shasta cautioned her. "You can't go down there. You'll hurt yourself." "You're scared," she mocked. "I am not." The taunt goaded him onto the rock-strewn slope, and they climbed downwards. Once Anneliese paused to pluck a spray of yellow flowers from a thorn bush. Then they went on, helping each other over the bad places, crouching under the thorn branches, teetering on the boulders, and hopping across the gaps like a pair of rock rabbits, until they reached the bottom of the ravine and paused to catch their breath. Shasta bent backwards from the waist and stared up at the cliff that towered above them, sheer as a fortress wall, but Anneliese tugged his arm to gain his attention. "It's a secret," she said. "You have to swear an oath not to tell anybody, especially not my brother. All right, I swear, said Shasta. You have to do it properly. Lift your right hand and put the other on your heart, she said. Solemnly, she led him through the oath, and then took his hand and drew him to a lichen-covered pile of boulders. Kneel down. He obeyed, and she carefully pulled aside a leafy branch that screened a niche amongst the boulders. Shasta gasped and pulled back, coming half to his feet. The niche was shaped like a shrine. There was a collection of empty glass jars arranged on the floor, but the wildflowers in them had withered and turned brown. Beyond the floral offering, a pile of white bones had been carefully arranged into a small pyramid, and surmounting this was a human skull, with gaping eye sockets and yellow teeth. "Who is it?" Shasta whispered, his eyes wide with superstitious awe. "The Witch of the Mountain," Annalisa took his hand. "I found her bones lying here, and I made this magic place." "How do you know she's a witch?" Shasta had a bad attack of the creeps by now, and his whisper shook and cracked. "She told me so." That raised such frightful images that he did not question her further. Skulls and bones were creepy enough. Voices from beyond were 100 times worse, and the hairs at the back of his neck and along his arms itched and stood erect. He watched while she changed the withered flowers for the fresh yellow acacia blossom, and then sat back on her ankles and took his hand again. "The witch will grant you one wish," she whispered, and he thought about it. "What do you want?" She tugged his hand. "Can I wish for anything?" he asked. "Yes, anything," she nodded, watching his face eagerly. Staring at the bleached skull, his awe faded. He was suddenly aware of a new sensation. Something seemed to reach out to him, a sensation of warmth and familiar comfort that he had known before only as an infant, when his mother held him to her bosom. There were still small pieces of dried scalp attached to the dome of the skull, like brown parchment, and tiny peppercorns of black hair, soft, furry little balls like those on the head of the tame bushman who herded the milk cows at the way station on the road from Windhoek. "Anything?" he repeated. "I can wish for anything?" "Yes, anything you want." Annalisa leaned against his side, and she was soft and warm, and her body smelled of fresh, sweet, young sweat. Shasta leaned forward and touched the skull on its white, bony forehead, and the sense of warmth and comfort was stronger. He was aware of a benign feeling, of love. That was not too strong a word. Yes, of love. As though he were being overlooked by someone or something that cared for him very deeply. "I wish," he said softly, almost dreamily, "I wish for enormous power." He imagined a prickling sensation in the fingertips that touched the skull, like the discharge of static electricity. And he jerked his hand away sharply. Annalisa exclaimed in exasperation and pulled her body away from him at the same time. "That's a silly wish!" She was clearly piqued, and he could not understand why. "You are a stupid boy, and the witch won't grant a stupid wish like that!" She flounced to her feet and drew the screening branch over the niche. "It's late. We must go back." Shasta did not want to leave this place, and he lingered. Annalisa called from up the slope. "Come on, it will be dark in an hour." When he reached the path again, she was sitting propped against the rock wall of the cliff, facing him. "I've hurt myself," she said it like an accusation, They were both flushed and panting from the climb. "I'm sorry," he gasped. "How did you hurt yourself?" She pulled the hem of her skirt halfway up her thigh. One of the red-tipped wait-a-bit thorns had roweled her, raising a long red scratch across the smooth, buttery skin of her inner thigh. It had barely broken the skin, but a line of blood droplets had welled up, like a necklace of tiny bright rubies. He stared at it as though mesmerized, and she sank back against the rock, lifted her knees and spread her thighs, holding the bunch of her skirts into her crotch. "Put some spit on it," she ordered. Obediently, he knelt between her feet and wet his forefinger. "Your finger is dirty," she admonished him. "Well, what shall I do then?" He was at a loss. "With your tongue. Put spit on it with your tongue." He leaned forward and touched the wound with the tip of his tongue. Her blood had a strange, salty, metallic taste as he licked it. She placed one hand on the nape of his neck and stroked the dense, dark curl of his hair. "Yes, like that. Clean it," she murmured. Her fingers twisted into his hair and she held his head, pressing his face to her skin, and then deliberately directed him higher, raising her skirt slowly with her free hand as his mouth travelled upwards. Then, peering between the spread of her thighs, he saw that she was sitting on a piece of her clothing, a scrap of white cloth printed with pink roses. And with a tingle of shock he realized that in the few minutes that she had been alone, she must have removed her panties and spread them as a cushion on the soft moss-covered earth. She was naked under the skirt. Shasta woke with a start, and he could not think where he was. The ground was hard under his back, and a pebble was digging into his shoulder. There was a weight across his chest, making it difficult for him to breathe. He was cold, and it was dark. Prester John stamped and snorted, and he saw the pony's head silhouetted against the stars. Suddenly he remembered. Annalise's leg was thrown over his, and her face was against his throat. She sprawled half across his chest. He pushed her off so violently that she woke with a cry. "It's dark," he said stupidly. "They'll be out looking for us by now." He tried to stand, but his breeches were around his knees. He remembered vividly the practiced way that she had unbuttoned them and worked them over his hips. He yanked them up and fumbled with his fly. "We've got to get back. My mother..." Annalisa was on her feet beside him, hopping on one leg as she tried to find the opening of her panties with her bare foot. Shasta looked at the stars. Orion was on the horizon. "It's after 9 o'clock," he said gloomily. "You should have stayed awake," she whined and put a hand on his shoulder to steady herself. "My pa will lather me. He said next time he'd kill me." Shasta shrugged off her hand. He wanted to get away from her, yet he knew he could not. "It was your fault." She stooped and grabbed her panties at the ankles, hoisted them to her waist, and then settled her skirts over them. "I'm going to tell Pa that it was your fault. He'll take the sjambok to me this time. Oh, he'll whop the skin off me." Shasta unhitched the pony, and his hands were shaking. He could not think clearly, and he was still half asleep and groggy. "I won't let him." His gallantry was half-hearted and unconvincing. "I won't let him hurt you." It seemed only to infuriate her. "What can you do? You're only a baby." The word triggered something else in her mind. "What will happen if you've given me a baby, hey? It'll be a bastard. Did you think of that while you were sticking that thing of yours into me?" she demanded waspishly. Shasta was stung by the unfairness of her accusation. "You showed me how. I wouldn't have done it if you hadn't." "A fat lot of good that's going to do us," she said, and she was weeping now. "I wish we could just run away." The notion held a definite appeal for Sasha, and he discarded it only reluctantly. "Come on," he said, and boosted her up onto Prestonjohn's back and then swung up behind her. They saw the torches of the search parties down on the plain below them as they turned the shoulder of the mountain. There were headlights on the road also, moving slowly, obviously searching the verges. And faintly they heard the shouts of the searchers, calling for them, as they moved about in the forest far below. "My pa's going to kill me this time. He'll know what we've been doing." She snuffled and sobbed, and her self-pity irritated him. He had long ago given up trying to comfort her. "How will he know?" he snapped. "He wasn't there." "You don't think you were the first one I've done it with?" she demanded, seeking to injure him. "I've done it with plenty of others, and Pa has caught me twice. Oh, he'll know, all right." At the thought of her performing those strangely marvellous tricks of hers with others, Shasta felt a hot rush of jealousy, which was gradually cooled by reason. "Well," he pointed out, "if he knows all about the others, it isn't going to do you much good to try to put the blame on me." She had trapped herself, and she let out another broken-hearted sob, and was still weeping theatrically when they met the search party coming on foot along the pipe track. Shasta and Annalisa sat on opposite sides of the bungalow's drawing room, instinctively keeping as far from each other as possible. As they heard the Daimler pull up outside in a flare of headlights and crunch of gravel, Annalisa began to weep again, snuffling and rubbing her eyes to work up a few more tears. They heard Santaine's quick, light tread across the veranda, followed by Twentyman Jones's more deliberate, stalk-like steps. Shasta stood up and held his hands in front of him, in the attitude of the penitent, as Santaine stopped in the doorway. She was dressed in yodhpurs and riding boots, and a tweed hacking jacket with a yellow scarf knotted at her throat. She was flushed and relieved and furious as an avenging angel. Annalisa saw her face and let out a howl of anguish, only half acting. "Shut your mouth, girl," Santaine told her quietly, "or I'll see you get good reason to blubber." She turned to Shasta. "Are either of you hurt?" "No, Mater." He hung his head. "Prestonjohn? Oh, he's in good fettle." "So, that's it then." She did not have to elaborate. "Dr. Twentyman Jones, will you take this young lady down to her father? I have no doubt that he will know how to deal with her." Santaine had spoken briefly to the father only an hour before, big and bald and paunchy, with tattoos on his muscled arms, belligerent and red-eyed, reeking of cheap brandy, and opening and closing his hairy paws as he mouthed his intentions towards his only daughter. Twentyman Jones took the girl by her wrist, pulled her to her feet, and led her, snivelling, towards the door. As he passed Santaine, her expression softened, and she touched his arm. "Whatever would I do without you, Dr. Twentyman Jones?" she asked quietly. "I suspect that you would get along very well on your own, Mrs. Courtney, but I'm glad I could help." He dragged Annalisa from the room, and they heard the whir of the Daimler's engine. Santaine's expression hardened again, and she turned back to Shasta. He fidgeted under her scrutiny. "You've been disobedient," she told him. "I warned you away from that little pool."
"Yes, Mater."
"She's been with half the men on the mine. We'll have to take you to a doctor when we get back to Windhoek."
He shuddered and glanced down at himself involuntarily, at the thought of a host of disgusting microbes crawling over his most intimate flesh.